published as a Veda researcher and teacher, translating and commenting on hymns from the Rig Veda in English and German. He's written a series of 19 articles on the Veda in light of Sri Aurobindo's psycho-spiritual interpretation that were published in German yoga magazines and other publications. During those years, he also gave Veda classes in English in cooperation with V.N. Senko at the Indian Psychology Institute at Puducherry. He gives talks and workshops on the Vedas in many German cities as well as Austria at different yoga centers and other institutions. Additionally, he conducts weekly meditations with hymns of the Rig Veda for Aurobindians and guests. At present, he is working on a book manuscript on the Veda that discusses Sri Aurobindo's much neglected or even unknown Veda research.
My name is Nishtha. I am originally German born. When I was 20 years, I was in a complete crisis of meaning of life, you know. Having grown up even on the countryside, living a simple life, but always somehow being dissatisfied with the life around me, also in the schooling. And then this went on when I went for apprenticeship in a kind of training and city and so on. And then when I was 20, it really had reached a point of, what is this all about, you know? And the world is not fair, and things are, you know, I felt like that. Yeah. To its own people, you know, this distinction, class and society and, you know.
Suffering.
You know. So I was really in a kind of terrible crisis. And then what happened, there was a magazine which a friend had given me and shown me, look, there was an article on Aurobindo. That was in 1976. Mm-hmm. So Aurobindo existed 8 years at that time. So there was an article about this, you know, primitive beginnings, like you still, some people do it now, starting in a field and you see, you know, it's all a desert and it's just very primitive. They live there. There's an idea of a different life. So I read this, and another coincidence, in this German article, in this magazine, it was mentioned that there, just a few weeks before, a book came out on Aurobindo in German. So of course I ordered that book, and when I opened this book, I was in a new world. It was like that what I had been waiting for. So that was very, really interesting. So it was a book on the whole story, the biography also of Sri Aurobindo and the mother and the first years of Aurobindo and the whole teaching and spirituality. And I had a Christian Catholic background, so I grew up with this. But then when you read the Indian spirituality, that this divine, you know, is not somewhere beyond in heaven waiting that if you live a good life, maybe you will reach there. But it's also, you can connect that in the life. So these were all revolutionary things, which in a way it seemed as if I was waiting for that, because I was very much touched by it and taken. And so immediately what came upon me with 20, you know, having traveled much, I have to go there, I have to see this place, together with that friend who had the magazine. So I did kind of odd job just to make enough money to get a plane ticket and come here. So this, but then of course being 20, not having traveled much, the first thing in Mumbai was the cultural shock in the slums and all that, you know. So that it was quite tough then for me. Then I came to Aurobindo and I had another shock, because in the book the whole thing was, you know, laid out in a way as if you would think it's already, it's already. Divine people are there and the city is there, and it was neither. So I really was quite shocked. And then after some weeks staying very primitive in a guest house in Aurobindo, you know, with snakes and all that kind of thing and diary, I went to Pondicherry and I stayed a few weeks there. But it's interesting because there they held the library and the bookshop, so I acquainted myself with more books of Sri Aurobindo and purchased them and went back home. And then when I was back home, I just thought, oh, what an awful nonsense you did, you know. This is just, I couldn't live like before, even then. So, in that sense, the crisis continued, and I wanted to live a different life. And then immediately I thought, no, I have to go back there. I've been running away, you know. than the first kind of shock. So anyway, that was my life then for 4 years, that every year I came here, you know, earning money just to get a ticket, spend some time here. But I say this also because in the first year, and then especially in the second stay, I hit already about Hymns to the Mystic Fire and Sri Aurobindo's poetry, and there was something in me, youngster, I was interested in poetry. And then you saw this whole selected book, Hymns to the Mystic Fire, which still is available today. There's a better new edition now on the website. But so I looked in these hymns, and when I returned the fourth time with the decision I wanted to stay, so of course then I embarked more into this. And then when we started the place here where I live, Agni, that was in, I think, Christmas 81 we started. I gave the name Agni already that time because I was reading about this Agni. And this is also to connect it with the Vedic kind of thing. Then people will tell me, ah, I know, fire, you know. But for me, it didn't mean fire, actually. So for me, Agni was more what Sri Aurobindo calls that psychic flame, what he calls, that soul spark in everyone, which actually is the goal of our, you know, search in Auroville as the basics for our life. From there, actually, we are supposed to build a new society. And if we haven't found that, we are, of course, and we know it, we're still doing the old thing. So that was the connection already that time with the Veda, that something in me got attracted to this imagery, you know, of this nature imagery of the gods, you could say. And also the language, the poetry. And then the next step was, of course, naturally to, I wanted to read the, on top of the English translation, there is the Devanagari. So I learned myself Devanagari, that I was able to read. And that's how I worked myself gradually into the Vedic hymns. And this was going on while at the same time we developed here this place, Agni, from the scratch, and I was planting trees and, you know, staying here around 5 years without moving, just watering the trees during summer. And at the same time sitting in my little kit hut with kerosene, like this, a chair and the not even a table, and studying the Vedic hymns. So that was very already from the very beginning I was really busy with this. And then during the course of the years, I also got interested, of course, along with Sri Aurobindo's works, I got interested in what else is there. So, of course, Upanishads is what they say follows the Veda, but from the Upanishads I went into Buddhism, and also from Buddhism into Chinese, you know, Buddhism and Zen Buddhism, and I had a big kind of survey of everything. But somehow I always came back to the Veda. This is that basic thing, and so this remained with me during all the years here, although then, of course, the focus was sometimes on something else. There was a strong period where I started to teach myself Western flute, the recorder, which is the straight flute. And along with this, I started to teach children in the school. So for about, I think, 7-8 years, I taught flute, not as a compulsory thing, but to those who wanted to do it in small groups or even single persons. And in my free time, I was still with the Veda. So you can imagine how long this thing goes on, which in a way I find it also naturally to. This is not which people would think, something you just get like that. It's like, because it needs a certain shift in the perception and the consciousness. And then at the same time, yes, I had not studied grammar, so I was just, you know, taking Sri Aurobindo's translations and comparing them to the original and just trying to connect the words. But that is not yet knowledge of grammar. So actually it was during this period in the 90s, I think 90s, beginning maybe of the new millennia, that still teaching flute, I took Sanskrit grammar classes with an Aurobindian here. Mm-hmm. And so for 4 years, every week we met and studied grammar, which then really, of course, makes another shift also if you get more into the language. And special in relation to the Veda, what was really helpful, because in when you learn Sanskrit, you learn, you know, even in the alphabet, you are learning already what is called this, I don't get the term, but the changes of vowels, for example. Now, what is a pure vowel, what is a mixed vowel, the strengthening, what is called guna, change of roots and things like. You have to, for example, you will know that deva, dev is not the root, the root would be div. So how the E becomes A through the mixing A sound into E and so on. And this was interesting because slowly the sounds, you know, they become more alive. And then while I was studying the Veda, you could see more and more this very conscious awareness of the rishis, how they use sound and the root suggestions in many directions, so to say. Mm-hmm. So that was really a big thing. Although this was basically classical Sanskrit, and I never really studied, you know, Vedic Sanskrit systematically, but I have a book, and then you just look it up, you know, you, and that helped, of course, also, even that what my teacher told me. You should know the whole thing, what is there, you know, what is available in the language when you study grammar. So that I did, and that really gave me a big push also, again, with the hymns, meaning I started more systematically to translate also. Write on it. And finally, it was like that. You feel music and Sanskrit both are kind of endless works, worlds, you know, to do. I decided to stop the flute. Even that time, I completely stopped to play myself also, and I really immersed myself fully into Sanskrit. And especially always the Vedic hymns. So for me, Sanskrit was actually mainly Vedic Sanskrit. So I got so much conditioned by these different sounds, colors of the ancient Sanskrit, which is the Vedic, that when I hear classical Sanskrit, it almost sounds modern or rational, intellectual, in comparison to the intuitive kind of Vedic paradigm, you know, so you could say.
So are you still researching the Vedas right now? And what is your current work?
Yes, okay. So I did it through many years in cooperation also with my teachers. We did different things in Auroville and Pondicherry. And at present I'm working on a book on the Veda, which I hope it would be a kind of bridge to Sri Aurobindo's work, The Secret of the Veda, because it's such a big thing and there is a huge scholarly part, which, you know, for the lay reader is in a way too much. And so I felt maybe I could make a kind of bridge to that. So it's a book which is supposed to have 18 chapters and give a kind of systematic introduction into this Vedic world in the light of Sri Aurobindo's research.
Okay. When do you think you'll be finished with the book?
I hope this year, but it's like, for example, the last 3 months, you could say, on a daily basis, I was engaged in 3 chapters which I find very important on the word, which in the Western tradition is called Logos, you know. In the Greek there is this thing, even in what is called in the, how you call it, it's not the Revelation of John, I think it is the one of the New Testaments, no? John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And they call it Logos. And then, of course, the rational people, they think, oh, logic, Logos. It is not that. So Logos, there, many scholars, they still wobble about it, but they would think it is that what in the Veda is called Vaj, the speech, or Brahman, which is also, people don't know that what later is called Brahman in the Upanishads. In the Veda, it is the term for the mantra. And Sri Aurobindo says that very beautiful. It is, so to say, the soul which expresses itself. So it can mean the word which the soul speaks, or the soul itself in the different contexts. And that is typically also in the Veda. So speech, because in the rational age, and even now people doing no SMS, language gets now more and more, how would you call it, abstract and concise and shortcut. And the Vedic, it's of course the totally opposite. And they would almost say, without word, if you have no word, that means you are not connected with your soul, because soul and word are one. When we speak, we express the inner, and if we have nothing to say, that means we are not connected with the inner. Whereas in the modern age, you know, in the rational age, we will say words are, you know, just nothing, they are unimportant, you know, we just use them very casually. Whereas there, the word is the soul expression. So this, I made three chapters on which I'm still working on this, what you call the Logos, based on the goddess, and also there is a god in the Veda, Brihaspati or Brahmanaspati, who is related to it. And then also in the third chapter, I want to say that how does this connect what in India is so much important, mantra practice. And there I want to highlight that for the rishis, in mantra practice, there is always thought involved. It is not something mechanical. It is something, it's a higher thought, it's an intuitive thought, but thought is always involved. Illumination means it is part of a thought process, you know. An evolution of the mind, a widening of the mind, transcending into higher layers of the mind. Which, by the way, is also very interesting. You find that in the Veda, and in a way you find it in Sri Aurobindo's work. So that's why also I always come back to him, because Veda and Sri Aurobindo, they explain each other, I would say. Mm-hmm.
Do you think this connection between Sri Aurobindo and the Vedas sort of been overlooked a little bit?
I would feel still like in India it has not been recognized, and the foreign scholars, as I say, in one book, an American scholar, he says, oh, he thinks that this fire is an inner fire, you know, like, that's all what he says about a work, you know, which compasses 1,000 pages or something, research which Sri Aurobindo did on the Vedas. So he's... his work is not yet really recognized, yes, so I thought after 100 years the time has come. I was traveling abroad 3-4 years ago when I was suffering from the summer, and then I went out, and in Europe, no, and in the States there is this whole yoga movement, and there people, of course, they also hear of Veda and they would like to know something about the root, but also their thinking is totally dominated by Patanjali thought, because that is part of the Hatha Yoga. That's their philosophy. So it wasn't easy to reach them also, but still people were very open, they don't know about it. And many, they were touched by this language, and so I felt maybe the time would have come now, gradually, slowly, that something of this different consciousness and approach could emerge again. But I always feel, in India also, if in India people will really get a deeper understanding of the Veda again, they will also much more appreciate Sri Aurobindo's teaching. Because in a way you feel he hasn't yet reached the tradition. But if the tradition is really, you know, dwelling more consciously again what the Vedic message really is, that it is not just a ritualistic bypass thing, but something very living and integrated. And the real, really the origin of the whole flow of Indian civilization, then I think they would also see so much connection there.
Sure,
of Sri Aurobindo.